Hello, and welcome to On Science. I'm science desk intern Megan Voss.
And I'm web producer Andrew Prince.
This week we have an alien perspective of human social skills,
a story on oil-eating bacteria,
and the discovery of two new solar systems.
But first, let's start with the latest stories from our series on evolution, The Human Edge. When most animals are in pain, they cry out or yelp. But as far as scientists can tell, humans are the only species that shed tears for emotional reasons.
I know I get choked up every time I watch Titanic. Our ancestors didn't have movies like Titanic to make them cry. But what did they have to gain from weeping? NPR's Allison Aubrey explored the reasons why we cry.
Actors have a few tricks to help them cry on cue. There's the fresh chopped onion, which'll really get the tear ducts going. And there are glycerin drops, a soap opera technique for coaxing those big, beautiful tears that roll down the cheeks. That's because it's really hard to cry unless you're really feeling something.
Crying has to come from emotion, right? That's where we all cry from anyway.
Jane Daly is an actress as well as a longtime acting instructor. She says tears come not only from grief or pain, they flow from all sorts of emotions.
Joy, the birth of a baby, and frustration, tears of frustration. They can be cathartic and releasing. It's what makes us completely human.
Tears are universal, and think about it for a minute. We need them to keep our eyes lubricated. But why on earth should streams of salty drops spew forth from our eyes, blurring our vision, making our eyes puffy, when we get emotional? Scientists who study evolution say crying probably conferred some benefit, did something to advance our species, because it's stayed with us. Looking back at our early human ancestors, psychologist Randy Cornelius of Vassar College says his hunch is that crying may have evolved as a kind of signal, a signal that was valuable because it could only be picked up by those closest to us who could actually see our tears.
You can imagine that there would be selection pressure to develop a signaling system that wouldn't let predators in on the fact that you're vulnerable, but that would let your intimates in, you know, somebody within a couple of feet of you who can see what's going on, and so then try to help.
To this day, tears continue to play an important role in communication. And the extraordinary thing is that tears don't just telegraph our state of mind to others. They can also evoke strong emotions in the people who witness them. We've all experienced at some point that we not only cry from our own pain, but we're moved to tears by other people's sadness.
I like to use the word empath. I think a lot of people know the word empathetic or empathy. There's sympathy and then there's empathy. Sympathy, you can feel sorry, you know, for somebody going through something terrible. Empathy or an empathic or empathetic person, i.e. a lot of actors, actually feel the darn thing.
Take Tom Hanks in the movie Saving Private Ryan. He plays a World War II Navy captain. In one scene, the company medic dies after desperate attempts to save his life. Hanks is overwhelmed.
He just breaks down sitting on an embankment on the side of a bridge at the loss, at another loss of a skilled, wonderful young man who barely had a chance to live. To see a grown man cry, it brings you to your knees.
And in that moment, we the audience feel it too. Witnessing these tears, we get choked up. And this is because as humans, one of our signature abilities is that we're able to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to feel what someone else is feeling, predict how they might react. Something academics call having a theory of mind.
So a theory of mind is something that even four-year-olds have. A theory of mind basically means that you have a theory about the unobservable psychological states that are governing or causing other people's behaviors.
Jesse Baring directs the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Belfast University. He says instinctively we pick up on gestures, facial expressions, body language, and that's just the beginning. He says this power of empathy is huge, and it's fundamental to pretty much everything we do, from forming close relationships to living in complex societies. Baring says those of our early ancestors who had the most empathy probably thrived because it helped them build strong communities, which gave them protection and support. Within these communities, Baring says tears could be powerful tools. They did more than just signal vulnerability. They were perhaps a way of keeping social and reproductive bonds strong. Maybe good criers were survivors.
Crying seems to elicit compassion and guilt, and that itself may be an evolved mechanism to save relationships that are in distress.
Baring says, take his own recent experience. Not long ago, he found out that his partner had cheated on him.
I mean, it was devastating, the fact that he cheated on me. And I was convinced that I was going to end the relationship right there.
But many apologies into a long conversation, his partner began to tear up.
He wasn't sobbing. It was not an hysterical cry. He was trying to choke back. He was trying to hide the fact that he was crying. And, you know, that was only through this discussion about our relationship and, you know, how much I had invested in it and how much he meant to me and how much he had hurt me. When I saw him cry, I realized that I was basically getting through to him.
Baring says he realizes that the tears did the heavy lifting here. The same conversation minus the tears may not have had the same effect. And Baring says this illustrates another aspect of crying. Whether it's intentional or unintentional, crying is a powerful way to get what you need or want. Think about how babies get your attention. They cry. And there's some evidence that natural selection favored infants whose cries were most alarming.
And as a consequence, these babies, who, of course, were our ancestors, would have been less likely to find themselves left alone or with strangers for long periods of time, and therefore less likely to befall genuine harm.
And crying can protect us throughout our lives. Just think about how you react when someone starts to cry.
I mean, just think about how difficult it is to punish somebody or to argue with somebody who is crying. I mean, it's like this sort of trigger that tells us to back off on that individual.
And tears don't often lie. Think about Tiger Woods and his public plea for sympathy after his extramarital affairs came to light.
I know I have bitterly disappointed all of you.
When he choked back tears, Men's Health editor Peter Moore says we all know where those tears were coming from.
They're kind of shameful tears. They're, I'm a dope. Look at what an idiot I am. Pity me, tears. And I think that, you know, spare me. I just soon draw the curtain over that one.
And maybe that's another reason evolution has kept humans crying. Tears help reveal the truth. And that's because, along with these tears, we've evolved a very sophisticated ability to interpret them. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Next, we're going to take a look at how our social nature has given us humans an advantage over other species. Humans have the ability to cooperate on a massive scale, but most of us take these skills for granted.
And to figure out just what it takes to work together, NPR's John Hamilton spoke with a young woman who has an unusual perspective on social behavior.
Before kindergarten, social skills aren't such a big deal, but that changes pretty quickly. Lisa Daxer was in elementary school when she noticed that she wasn't like her classmates.
I realized that I was different in more ways than just being better at reading and math. I realized that they had friends and I didn't.
She never did learn to navigate the social landscape of grade school.
About in the fifth grade, I realized that I should probably try to stop making friends because it wasn't going to be very successful.
And social stuff is still hard for Lisa. She's 27 now and going to college in Dayton, Ohio.
I go to Wright State. I'm a biomedical engineering major, and I have a weird brain. They call it autism, but to be honest, the label matters less than the fact that I'm who I am. I'm here because I like to learn.
Autism often makes Lisa feel like an outsider, an alien. But it's also given her an unusual perspective on the social behavior of people she calls neurotypical.
Neurotypical is anyone who doesn't have a weird brain, anyone who is in the middle of the neurological bell curve.
Lisa writes about neurotypicals in a blog called Reports from a Resident Alien. And we asked her to record some of her observations in an audio diary.
Hi, this is Lisa. It's 12:25 p.m. I'm sitting in the Student Union atrium. and I'm watching people.
Lisa's not the first person with autism to describe herself as almost like an alien observing other humans.
Simon Baron-Cohen studies autism at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He says people like Lisa have taught scientists a lot about the way humans interact socially.
So we didn't really focus on how complex social development is until people with autism pointed out to us that this is something that doesn't always just develop naturally.
The importance of eye contact, how to read facial expressions and social cues, how to fit into a group. These are so much a part of the way humans relate to one another that most people aren't even aware of them. But Lisa is.
Do you want to go in there?
Standing
there?
On a grassy slope on campus, Lisa blends in with the other students. Baggy clothes, backpack, a computer thumb drive dangling from a lanyard around her neck. But inside the student union, it's a different story.
Coffee shop, the lifeblood of the college. Lots of people, basically. They eat here, they hang out here, they study here. I don't.
Lisa watches them through oval glasses, but she doesn't meet their eyes or talk to anyone. She says her fellow students tend to clump.
By default, they socialize. You have to actually interfere to stop neurotypicals from socializing. They're drawn to each other like non-existent unipolar magnets.
In coffee shops, at parties, even while dissecting human hearts in the anatomy lab. Baron-Cohen says this constant socializing is no accident.
Amongst primates, particularly social primates, it is important to stay within the group. And if we took an evolutionary perspective, that would be for physical survival. A member who becomes separated from the group is at increased risk of predators, to put it bluntly.
So the humans who survived were predisposed to have what you might call a social brain. It's still with us. Think fraternities or Facebook. If you want to be part of a group, you constantly monitor your status with other members.
You're picking up cues about what they might find acceptable or interesting or unacceptable, and picking up those cues very early could mean the difference between inclusion and exclusion. If you've done something that might offend somebody or upset somebody, it's good to notice that quickly so that you can fix it.
Before they defriend you. Belonging to a group also means following unwritten rules, like not violating taboos. And our social brains are really good at this. It doesn't take long for most kids to realize that you don't just blurt out that someone is fat or old or stupid. To Lisa's brain, though, these are just facts. She had to make a list of topics that seem to offend neurotypicals.
Don't talk about sex. Don't talk about the anatomy lab. Don't talk about surgery. Don't talk about anything that happens in the bathroom.
And that list is far from done. She recently figured out that death is off limits, too.
I hadn't realized that. And had been talking about it to my friends until someone, actually the church librarian, mentioned to me that she thought it was a depressing topic to talk about.
Lisa still doesn't really get taboos. She thinks these subjects just irritate neurotypicals, the way people with autism can be irritated by certain sounds or certain textures.
We all avoid different things. I avoid polyester clothing. They avoid talking about death.
But there's more to it than that. Taboos are just one of the vast number of social rules we don't even know we know. Don't stand too close. Don't stare. Take turns. But this is just the beginning of what our social brains learn to do. Lisa says she realized this when she lived in a group house with other students.
It's kind of funny. One of my other housemates loved the show Friends, and I think it's a silly show. A very neurotypical show, actually. It's all about relationships.
I'm going to ask Phoebe to move in with me.
Oh, my God.
What do you think?
I think that it's so great. Oh, my God, I'm so excited.
I would watch their faces as they watched the show. They were mirroring the people on the screen, I think.
Can I tell you, do not get her flowers, okay?
Unconsciously mimicking their smiles, their frowns, their body language. To Lisa, that was a revelation. It's something she doesn't do. But Baron-Cohen says it's something most children start doing before age 2.
They're looking up at people's faces. They're paying attention to people's facial expressions, and they're responding. So if someone looks sad, they will mirror the expression.
This sort of mirroring is probably the basis for one of the most complex and important social skills, empathy. The typical human brain has evolved an extraordinary ability to see the world from another person's point of view. That helped our ancestors get along. It's also the reason humans and some other species care for members of their group who are injured or sick. Lisa learned a lot about empathy from one of her housemates.
I would call her super neurotypical because she had extremely, extremely good social skills.
At the time, Lisa was feeling increasingly depressed and isolated. She says this woman seemed to understand.
I think she knew that I was hurting, and she didn't want me to hurt anymore.
But Lisa's depression got worse. Eventually, she ended up in the hospital.
She visited me in the mental ward. In our society, being crazy is considered very, very frightening. And this girl, when I had depression, she visited me in the mental ward. That takes courage, that takes friendship, that takes empathy.
Simon Baron-Cohen says empathy may have evolved from the relationship between parent and child.
If the parent has empathy, they're going to be able to imagine that the infant might be in pain or discomfort or hungry or tired or in need of affection, a whole range of mental states. So empathy would have promoted better parenting.
And the genes involved in empathy would get passed on to the next generation. But empathy isn't just about raising children and caring for the sick. If you can look at the world from another person's point of view, it's much easier to take on common goals. You can cooperate, which is one of the keys to human success.
Hey, this is Lisa. I'm sitting outside my church in the parking lot. So, at church, something interesting happened. The pastor comes up and says, okay, we need to change the fellowship hall to a dining hall. So, they had that fellowship hall turned from a place with, you know, a couple of hundred chairs to a place with a couple of dozen tables and chairs and tablecloths and place settings and everything in about 15 minutes flat.
Dozens of people working together with hardly a word exchanged, just glances and body language and a common purpose.
Again, it's something that you see in humans. You don't see very much of that in other species. You know, the idea that two humans could pick up a log that's way too heavy for one person to carry, but between the two of them, they can lift it and move it. And, you know, that's obviously enabled human beings to do all kinds of things, like put up buildings.
Or spaceships. Lisa sometimes asks herself why, from an evolutionary perspective, people with autism are still around. She's come up with one possible scenario. It involves a caveman named Bob.
So let's say caveman Bob invents fire. But because he's autistic, he's too nerdy for the cave women. So he doesn't have any children. I mean, how is that an advantage when it comes to natural selection? You'd think it wouldn't be.
But if Bob's discovery gives his tribe an advantage, his relatives will be able to have more children even if he never has any. So his genes, including those involved in autism, will be passed on to future generations. Baron Cohen says that's a plausible explanation.
As tool users, you know, we always needed individuals in the group who could invent new tools, whether we're talking about in Stone Age, just flints, or in the modern age, new computer chips.
Of course, that still doesn't account for autism that is completely disabling. Lisa Daxer says she doesn't want a typical brain. Her autism is part of who she is, and she enjoys that her brain loves patterns and facts. But she says she will probably always feel like a bit of an alien.
I wonder what it is like to be one of a unit of two. I don't know. But then again, they'll never know some of the beautiful things I see. The tiny little patterns on a leaf, or the intricacies of a circuit, or learning a new fact and almost squealing in joy because it's so beautiful.
The gap between Lisa and the neurotypical world will never disappear. People still treat her as different. But she has done a remarkable job of adapting. She has learned to make friends and to find colleagues who value her scientific work. And Lisa says she has come to appreciate the power of what neurotypicals can do with their social brains.
I've seen them help people who are hurt. I've seen them draw together networks of people to make the world better. I've seen them connect different sorts of minds so that we could all communicate and live in a single society. I know you take it for granted, but it's really very amazing to be able to do that.
John Hamilton, NPR News.
A new research study has found that bacteria are consuming oil from the spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
This news was pretty surprising because another group of scientists reported only a few days earlier that they had not found oil-eating bacteria in the Gulf. NPR's Christopher Joyce has the story.
Last week, oceanographer Christopher Reddy from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution said his team had found a big underwater oil plume in May and June. But curiously, the waterborne bacteria that like to eat oil apparently had not found it. Reddy said microbes are about as predictable as teenagers.
Microbes are pretty selective in how they eat oil. Sometimes they kick in, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they do the easiest work, they don't do the hard work.
The hard work is what scientists had been hoping to see. Bacteria consuming the more toxic chemicals in the oil plume and rendering them harmless. Reddy said sooner or later, the bugs should show up. Apparently, they have.
There's this unique cold-loving bacteria.
That's microbiologist Terry Hazen with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California.
They actually grow better at 5 degrees than they grow at room temperature.
Hazen and a large team of scientists found these new cold water bacteria in the oil plume 3,000 feet deep. There are several kinds of microbes, in fact, and they're eating the oil.
Oil is the only carbon source down there deep, so they immediately take advantage of that. And of course, they have undoubtedly been adapted to that over millions of years.
That's because oil has been in the water for millions of years, bubbling up from the seabed.
The Gulf has natural seeps that have been putting the equivalent of an Exxon Valdez spill into the Gulf every year.
So why hadn't other scientists seen the bacteria? One possibility is that they were looking for low oxygen levels in the water and didn't find them. Low oxygen is the principal sign that lots of bacteria are eating oil. But Hazen says in this case, ocean currents and the use of dispersants has spread the oil out into a thin veil of tiny droplets. So the bacteria are spread out too. The reason Hazen's team found the bacteria is that they looked for bacterial DNA and enzymes that their microbes express when they eat oil. That makes sense to microbiologist Benjamin Van Mooy.
The thing I'm learning from this project is there is no shortage of surprises from the microbial point of view.
Van Mooy was on the team from Woods Hole that did not find the oil-eating bacteria.
Every oil spill is unique because the oil has a unique composition, and it's also being released into an environment with its own unique chemical and physical factors at play. And then there's also the microbial community.
Scientists working on the Gulf spill say that's why it's hard to predict how the remaining oil in the Gulf will behave. Conditions in the Gulf are different from, say, Alaska, where the Exxon Valdez went aground. The BP oil was released at the sea floor under great pressure. Dispersants spread it out into cold water, but as it rose, it reached much warmer water. Hazen says it appears that the combination of bacteria and ocean currents can degrade and disperse the remaining oil in a matter of weeks.
It does fit with what we've seen. So in the last 3 weeks, the plume at depth is completely undetectable.
You're saying the plume is gone?
Yeah.
But gone doesn't necessarily mean the Gulf is free of BP's pollution. Van Mooy points out that oil has scores of chemical constituents. Bacteria consume the low-hanging fruit first. The harder stuff takes longer to digest. And scientists who track oil say the plume may thin out in one place and then pop up in another. They're continuing to look for signs of that all over the Gulf. The research, published in the journal Science, was funded by the Federal Energy Department, along with support from BP through a university consortium. Scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say they're following the fate of the microbes and the plume. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Let's move away from Earth now and head into space. Astronomers are always on the hunt for new planets, hoping to find one that resembles Earth. This week, astronomers found not one, but two new solar systems.
And these are not planets where life could survive, but scientists are optimistic that someday they will find an inhabitable planet. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
Many of the world's experts on planets in outer space are playing top this at a scientific conference in southeastern France this week. Among them is Matthew Holman from the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
There's always an element of competition. You know, people come and want to show their best work and they want to surprise their colleagues.
Holman had to keep his own surprise under wraps for a few days because it hadn't yet been published. So he just listened as his European competitors claimed the spotlight. Christoph Lovis from the University of Geneva in Switzerland announced on Tuesday his group had discovered a whole collection of planets orbiting a star 127 light years away.
At least five planets and probably seven. Two of them are still a little bit uncertain.
It's the largest solar system ever seen outside our own. Now, Lovis didn't really see any of those planets. So far, that's impossible. He watched stars very carefully as they move through space. If they speed up or slow down a little in a regular pattern, it shows there's something tugging on them, the gravitational pull of an orbiting planet. This has been the most successful planet hunting technique, but it works best for giant planets close to small stars. Of the 500 planets discovered so far, most have been like this. One of the new planets that Lovis announced, however, appears to be much smaller. Its mass is just 40% greater than Earth.
We've really moved from giant planets only to any kind of planetary system with more and more planets, small mass planets, and so on. It's really exciting.
And yesterday, Matthew Holman finally got to add his bit of excitement when his discovery was published by the journal Science.
We're announcing the discovery of two Saturn-sized planets, which we call Kepler-9b and Kepler-9c.
And there's evidence of a third planet, he said, a much smaller one. Its diameter appears to be just 50% larger than Earth's.
If it is confirmed, it would have a radius of about 1.5 times the radius of the Earth.
Holman's discovery, in fact, is an early scientific harvest from NASA's new planet-finding machine, a telescope called Kepler. This instrument is following Earth in its orbit around the Sun, staring constantly at a group of 100,000 stars in another corner of our galaxy. When the light from any of those stars dims slightly, it's evidence that a planet just crossed in front of it. Now, the planets that scientists have found so far are not what you'd call habitable. The small ones are way too close to their stars. But Kepler was designed specifically to detect planets just like Earth. And Alan Boss, an astrophysicist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, is increasingly confident those planets are out there.
We're finding more and more evidence that Earth-like planets are going to be quite common. We don't have them yet, but we're well along the way towards discovering them.
We'll all have to be patient, though. A planet just like Earth crosses in front of its star once a year, and scientists won't declare it a planet until they see the star's light dim at least three times. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
And that's all for this week. For more science news and to find all the stories in our Human Edge series on evolution, be sure to check out our website. That's npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.
And I'm Megan Boss. Thanks for listening.